2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 153. How many organizational psychologists does it take to change a hierarchy? Observations on the importance of context, leadership, and culture. Participants,
and I want to welcome you to session 153. How many organizational psychologists does it take to change a hierarchy? Our principal presenter is Mike Stevens. Mike, in addition to being a member of the Board of Trustees of the Sunstone Foundation, is also a professor of organizational behavior at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. He grew up here in the Salt Lake area, comes from solid pioneer stock, and claims to have Mormon genetic markers in his DNA. Professionally, he's an organizational psychologist and an academic researcher with interests in the interplay between interpersonal effectiveness, organizational culture, and leadership. He also works extensively as in the consulting and training arenas, focusing on teamwork and executive and management coaching. Responding to his presentation will be Jeff Christensen, Jeff's principal with Future Vision Technologies here in Salt Lake. Jeff and Mike were classmates at Purdue, it turns out, and known each other for some time. I noted that Michael Quinn's presentation next door used the term organizational behavior, had the temerity to use the term organizational behavior in his title, and I'm here to testify that this is the only true section on organizational behavior. And here's Mike Stevens.
I guess that's what would qualify as a faith-promoting rumor, some might say. So I'm in the area of professionally organizational behavior, so if any of you know any organizations that are misbehaving, feel free to chat me up after the session. What I have in mind to do this afternoon is really a talk more about kind of my current state of thinking professionally and work that I've done, and kind of take that from the world of working with leaders in the more traditional corporate environment, and the impact that their leadership styles have on the culture in the organizations, and translate that back into the special kinds of issues that we face in a hierarchical organization such as the LDS Church, obviously. In some senses, they're similar sorts of issues. In a number of senses, there are also a number of challenges. But I have in mind talking through a number of issues then, and opening it up for questions. And given that we're up against the big guns next door, I want all three of you here, two or four of you here, to come up with a question at the end. Otherwise, we'll finish early. So, in any event, what I wanted to do, first of all, is paint a little picture about the need for organization and structure in most any human enterprise. In fact, if you go back to what we understand as the creation process, creation itself is the process of bringing order out of chaos. One of the unique differences of Mormon theology as opposed to mainline Christian theology concerning creation is the idea that rather than believing a creation ex nihilo, we believe in God organizing the elements that were already present. So the idea of organization and organizing is something that springs out of the very process of creation itself, where God brought order out of chaos. Of course, the downside is that chaos can be confusing and frustrating and debilitating for many of us. On the other hand, it can also be very exhilarating and challenging and lead to great creativity. But the flip side of that is, as you bring order out of chaos, that order can very quickly lend itself to a sense of oppression or even unrighteous dominion, as we're told in the scriptures. To really understand, I guess, the modern-day preoccupation with autocratic structures and hierarchical organizations, I think really is enlightening if you back up about a century and look at the kind of things that happen at the beginning, at the point of maturation in the Industrial Revolution. And if you look at what was going on prior to economic enterprise that we characterize as the Industrial Revolution today, we would probably look at that and conclude that, you know, if 90% of all human beings earn their economic livelihood, their daily temporal activity through small, you know, family kind of operations where they were, working a plot of land in an agrarian type of model, 95% would probably be low. And the only few who weren't were the specialized craftsmen and underscore men, because you know, there were a few very specialized individuals who were the blacksmiths, the coopersmiths, the machinists, and so on, as the Industrial Revolution started to grow and evolve. And interestingly enough, that work, though, was not really organized in the sense that we know and understand it today, but was really based on a model of small craft type of production, where you had a master craftsman who had spent many, many years in the apprentice of another master craftsman to learn a trade, machining, and the shop was small, it was informal, there was no need for bureaucratic hierarchy or autocratic styles and structures of management. Well, along about 1908, 1910, 1914, a fellow named Henry Ford came along and started monkeying around with this process of manufacturing, you know, in particular automobiles, and through a series of trial and errors, he came up with something that he finally called the Model T. He started literally with the Model A, and you go through the alphabet. 20 versions later, you come to letter T, and his 20th iteration of the automobile that he wanted to mass produce was in fact the Model T. And Henry Ford is the one really who pioneered bringing together lots of ideas and strategies and whatnot at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to manufacture the automobile. But the spillover in terms of the rest of at least Western society has been no nook or cranny has been left untouched, pretty much in industrialized Western society, based on the ideas and principles and things of that nature that Henry Ford helped pioneer and the others around him helped to perfect. And essentially, if you look at the model, the challenge that they were faced with, what they had to do was figure out how to take this process of manufacturing an automobile that might have, say, you know, 10,000 different steps in the manufacturing process, and where in the traditional craft model, that was being done by, you know, two or three individuals in a craft shop were doing all 10,000 steps. Well, eventually, he perfected this idea of having 10,000 people do one step and laid out the process that we know as the assembly line. There were a lot of things he had to figure out along the way, and one of those was how to bring together 10,000 different people doing these individualized jobs and coordinate and integrate and bring order out of what could be potentially chaos. You can't simply run an enterprise or an operation such as an assembly process with 10,000 people, you know, running, doing whatever they thought would be appropriate on a shop floor. And so in terms of engineering and the creation of the product, he had to come up with a design that was compatible with the process he was seeking to perfect. But he also had to perfect the organizational support systems and structures to do that. And through over a period of time, he and other experts hit upon what some people have referred to as the Holy Trinity of organizational structure, and that is the way you coordinate and integrate is you do three things. You standardize, you specialize, and you centralize. And this is nothing new to the world. I mean, you can go back to the Old Testament, see how Moses had to organize the children of Israel into bands of 50 with captains over 50 and so on, reported it up to them. And depending on the kind of numbers that they're estimated as to the children of Israel that Moses had to manage, potentially millions. So one of the frustrations that Moses had was that he had everybody running to him with their own problems because he was at the head. There was no structure between Moses at the top and the millions of Israelites directly underneath him. And so they came up with this idea of the captains of 50 and so on who reported to other captains and on up the chain of command. Well, like Henry Ford and the others at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution,
they found that this idea of standardizing, specializing, and centralizing allowed them to bring tremendous order out of a potentially chaotic situation. And what we mean by those three things, standardization is very, very simply the idea that you micromanage everything to death. You tell people what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. And you don't let them question. You don't let them work through the details. In fact, that would be problematic. That would bring chaos into the system. And that as you move up the structure, the hierarchy, the argument is that there are people further up the pyramid that are all knowing and all understanding, and so they're able to work through all those kind of issues that would plague people in the trenches. And so your job was to just be quiet and do your job, because you know, if you were so smart, well, then you'd be running things. So that was kind of the idea behind standardization. The idea behind specialization is very clearly the idea that you have one person do one thing, and by doing that, they can become very, very efficient. They can become very effective at it. They can figure out how to do it very, very quickly and very easily. And that, in fact, was true. And the third point, the idea of centralization goes with the idea of decision-making. That is, when we talk about centralization, we're talking about taking all decision-making and centralizing it in the center and as high up in the hierarchy as we can. Well, like all human endeavors, there's something called the law of unintended consequences that came along with this strategy that began to go from Henry Ford and the automotive industry to pretty much all the rest of our economic industrialist enterprises in the Western world anyway. And it was that very soon they found out that there were a number of disadvantages to this approach. One of those was that this approach towards bureaucratic and autocratic organizations was intended to create work that was psychologically very alienating to people. It also tended to create organizational cultures that were based on values of control and obedience and submission. Those were the values of the day. And the third thing is that they also tended to create systems and structures that were inflexible almost really by design. They were intended to standardize and remove variance out of the system because that would be easier to manage. So in effect, the main advantage of autocratic structures is that they organize themselves around this holy capitalistic trinity of standardization, specialization, and centralization. But the main disadvantage is that they organize themselves around these principles of standardization, specialization, and centralization. Now, whether you think that's good or bad really is a function, I think, of where you are personally, philosophically, in terms of your own values and belief system and whatnot. You need to ask yourself, what is it that we should try to achieve or attain through our organizational enterprises as human beings? Do we want stability and consistency and predictability and coordination and integration? Or do we want freedom and flexibility and individual discretion? In large measure, about a century of widespread experiment with this strategy in organizational management tells us that you got to choose one or the other. You can float around somewhere in between, and there's some strategies that people have adopted to kind of get the best of both worlds, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But the other thing I want to spend a few minutes addressing is the interplay between organizational structures and culture, and by doing that, hopefully point out some relevance or some issues we might talk about in terms of more immediate structures like the church that we belong to might be germane to our discussion. When we talk about culture, I know that you know there are different disciplines that use the same words and define them differently. So it might help if I speak or talk about the kind of culture that I'm referring to. I mean, really, those of us in organizational behavior talk about the idea of structure, essentially we're talking about the values and the beliefs and the assumptions and the mental models that are characteristic of the organization. Those are the things that we would call the underlying core of culture. There's a different dimension of culture, which we refer to as artifacts of culture, which are the things that are observable. They're the things that you can hear in conversation. They're the things that you can see, the symbols, the rituals, the ceremonies, the ways in which people talk to each other and address each other, the stories they tell, the physical structures, usage of space and architecture, the rituals and ceremonies. And most of these artifacts are, of course, what we all see and what we all experience. Rules, policies, and procedures are in large part an artifact of the underlying values and assumptions and beliefs and mental models of the core of the culture in an organization. And to give you an idea of the kinds of things I'm talking about here, if we were to look at examples of artifacts within the LDS organizational culture, one of those things would be the rituals and language that we use in titles when we speak to each other, when we refer to each other, when we greet each other. Do we refer to each other as Brother Joseph or President Joseph, or Brother Hinckley versus President Hinckley, Elder so-and-so versus Brother so-and-so or Sister. Those are the kind of things that reflect a core set of underlying values and beliefs and kind of mental models about values concerning relationships between people. Different kinds of rules and policies and procedures also communicate very powerfully what the underlying values and beliefs and mental models are of the organization. For example, there was a recent policy decision to have local units remove websites on the internet until a standardized, centralized set of policy guidelines could be written indicating what local church units should do. So, my ward in St. Louis, for example, had to pull its website, or at least it was supposed to, until the centralized policy came out. There are other sorts of artifacts in our culture. Now, for example, the use of, or the recommendation we use only the King James Version of the Bible in our formal lessons and things of that nature. The standardization of architectural formats. The idea that in order to be eligible to function as a temple worker, you males can no longer have facial hair, and sisters, you can no longer have a second set of earrings. Those are all examples of artifacts that we can all see, we may or may not be comfortable with, kind of depending on where you are in terms of your own philosophy and personal journey and whatnot. But the thing that is worth pointing out in terms of culture is the idea that these reflect underlying mental models about what's right and wrong. And in order to understand the shaping, I think, of those cultural values, it's important to also appreciate where those cultures emerge from. That is, why is it that any particular organization, church included, has the culture that it has? Well, in large measure, it has to do with the original founders. That's usually true for the first generation or two, and depending on how strongly that culture is set within the organization, it may endure quite a while. But at some point, generations can become removed from the original founders of that culture, whether it's an entrepreneur in a business setting or a charismatic leader in a religious organizational setting. Successors will come along in leadership role. And almost by definition, what those leaders are going to do is they are going to define what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And implicitly and explicitly, then they end up defining for us what those values are that undergird the artifacts of culture that we see. There are also other influences, broader cultural transference. For example, the fact that an organization like the church grew up through most of its history in the Intermountain West, I'm sure, has lent flavor to its culture that is very different from what it might have been had it been raised up in some other geographical area, perhaps. And maybe the most interesting from an organizational studies point of view as to where cultures emerge is more a question of how they're perpetuated. And in large measure, there is a certain element about culture that is self-reinforcing as new members are brought in and socialized to the norms and values and mental models that are in operation. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. Most of us end up coming to a sense of ourselves in the world and adopting surrounding cultures before we even realize it. Much like many of us end up learning to speak a language with an accent before we realize that we have it. I remember when I was 12 years old and playing Little League football here in Salt Lake. Our team had the opportunity to go and play down in Southern California. They put the team on a bus. We went down to Southern California, played a team down there. And in order to be economically efficient, they had us stay in the homes of the families of the boys on the teams we were playing. This was all fine and dandy until the last day I was there. And the other 12-year-old fellow on the team I was playing with, I was about to leave, and he looked at me and said, "You know what? You got a funny accent." I remember looking at him and saying, "No, dude, you're the one with the accent." It had never occurred to me at that tender age that I might be the one who had the accent. This is often the case, even well into adulthood. My students often, when we talk about global culture sorts of issues in the classes they teach in the College of Business, I'll ask them to describe their culture in St. Louis. And half the students look at me with a blank stare as if that question just simply does not connect. That it never really occurred to them that they have a culture. It just kind of, we come to knowledge and we come to being and kind of accept the way we've grown up and been socialized as the default, and everyone else is the one with the accent or the culture, what have you. And so what happens is we grow up in these cultures, the artifacts that I was talking about, in large measure will communicate to us what the mental models are, what the values are, what the assumptions and beliefs are that we're supposed to have. And then those values and beliefs and assumptions also get reinforced in new policies and practices and rituals and so on. And Mike Quinn, for example, when he talks about the extensions of hierarchy, he explains how he took the time at one point to actually go through and read every single issue of the church news from 1931 up to the present day. And one of the things that he cataloged was how the term prophet was used. And his conclusion was that he found only one instance from 1931 to the mid-1960s when the living president of the church was referred to as the prophet. During that period of time, the president of the church was always referred to as either, President Grant or Mr. Smith, and never referred to as the prophet. Come 1965, there's a complete reversal. And so something as simple as an artifact of our culture, which is, the greetings and titles that we use when we address each other, communicate very, very powerful messages. I mean, it's one thing to disagree politically or in terms of social issues or policies with Mr. Hinckley. It's another thing altogether to disagree with the prophet, the living prophet, right? So these are the kinds of things that these artifacts and whatnot not only emerge out of our norms and values and beliefs, but also have a very, very powerful influence in terms of reinforcing those as well. And I think that's also one of the reasons why we see the kind of passage of Scripture in the New Testament, where the Savior is talking to us about the parable of the wheat and the tares. I actually brought my non-standard King James Version of the Bible to share that passage. I think it's very enlightening. I think points to one of the very difficult challenges we face in terms of separating out things culturally from things that are what we would call gospel-rooted principles in our religious experience today in the church. The parable of the wheat and tares is told in Matthew chapter 13, starts in verse 24, which coincidentally picks up right after Jesus taught the parable of the sower, how the sower goes forth and sows the ground or sows the seeds in different grounds. Some take root, some don't do well. He immediately follows that up with a parable, starting in verse 24, which says, Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went away. Now, I've never seen a tare. I've got to be honest with you. I have been told, though, on people who may or may not be expert authorities, it was a seminary teacher, but I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. The information he shared with our seminary class was that when the tare emerges early on, it has a little shoot that's just a few inches high. Looks remarkably close to a shoot of wheat. So it's very difficult to early on to distinguish one from the other. In any event, the wheat and the tares grow up. In verse 26, we're told that when the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the tares also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from? And the answer was, An enemy did this. The servants asked him, Do you want us to go and pull them up? And what was the answer? He said, No. Because, why? That's right. Because while you're pulling up the tares, you may root up the wheat with them also. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned. Then gather the wheat and bring them into my barn. It's very, very difficult for any organization, especially one which claims to have rules, policies, practices, things of that nature that reflect the will of God, to entertain the idea of the possibility that a lot of what we do may reflect really cultural baggage, if you will, that's not rooted in the essential principles of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So that's a real challenge. And part of I guess what I'm suggesting is the idea that when you look at our culture, organizational culture in the church, and you see a lot of these artifacts that may not square with the mental models that you and I may have, or the underlying values and beliefs and assumptions. It's important to, essentially we're talking about ideally we would like to change those kinds of things. And that would be wonderful, I suppose, if we're all in a position to do that. And hence the title for my presentation this afternoon, How Many Organizational Psychologists Does It Take to Change a Hierarchy? Well, of course, the punchline to that is only one, but the hierarchy has to really want to change. And that is, in essence, large part of the final leg of what I want to speak about this afternoon, which is how do you change a hierarchy? And the connection here in terms of hierarchy or autocracy or leadership is that, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of times these underlying norms, values, beliefs, assumptions, and so on come from the initial founder of the organization, are perpetuated by successors, even changed by successors. And if you really want to understand in large measure where any culture in an organization comes from, it is the one phenomenon in organizational life that is subject to the law of gravity. It flows very, very quickly from the top down and rarely, if ever, bubbles up from the bottom. If it does bubble up from the bottom, it will only be tolerated to the degree that the decision makers, the leaders in terms of deciding what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, it will only survive to the degree that they countenance it or embrace it or allow it to be part of the culture. So how then do you change that hierarchy? Well, in large measure, the question itself is fairly presumptuous. And it's presumptuous, I would suggest, in at least three different ways. It is presumptuous in that it assumes that we need to change. It is presumptuous in that it assumes that the decision makers in charge of allowing that change to happen are want it to, and it is presumptuous in the degree that we believe, kind of inherently in asking the question, that we know what the change should be to, what we should be moving to. And in large measure, I think that's a function of our natures as human beings. Most of us have a very clear sense of what our own ideas, beliefs, attitudes, and opinions are. In fact, if I were to ask those of you in this room here, how many of you hold ideas, beliefs, and opinions that you knowingly are aware are false, how many hands would we go up? Okay, two. Well, that's three. That's pretty good. But that's the exception. I've actually asked that question in quorum lessons and Sunday school classes over the years, and you just outstrip that number by three. I mean, obviously, you know, we would not have our ideas, our values, our beliefs, opinions if they were false. We would jettison. We would throw them overboard. And that's true whether we're on the right-hand side or the left-hand side of the spectrum. Those of us, and I would include myself on the left of center in terms of that spectrum, would have to say that most of us would like to see changes, but changes that are reflective of our agenda. We're perfectly comfortable with rules, policies, and procedures that take the organization where we want to be taken. We're happy with micromanagement that gives us the agenda that we want, but not so pleased when it comes from others taking us in a different agenda. I believe that's in large measure at the heart of why Section 121 tells us that it is the propensity of almost all mankind, whether you're on the right or the left or the center, to exercise unrighteous dominion, to further your agenda onto others, onto an organization, onto any kind of a human enterprise, when in fact others may not be like-minded. So what do you do? Well, it brings us to a genuine challenge. How do you invite people and usher them through a change process when there are obviously significant barriers to change going on? I mean, essentially, you know, we can talk at some like macro level about institutional change and in terms of how you restructure reporting relationships, and that can have an impact. You can talk about how you would redesign functions and how they interact within an organization. So there are institutional kinds of things that you can do to affect change. But more often than not, real change takes place at the level of individuals, whether they be individual members or individual leaders within an organization. Most human beings are reluctant to change for a number of reasons. And part of my research, I've developed a change model that I use as I work with leaders in corporate world to try to go through a change away from autocratic types of leadership tendencies that are still quite common in a corporate world towards a more empowering sort of a model. And as I've done that over the years, I've been faced with resistance on a number of fronts, and I thought I'd just take a minute and share those with you and see where that discussion leads us. One of the barriers has to do with what I call cognitive barriers. And there are really two parts to this. Cognitive barriers consist of, on the one hand, inadequate mental models. Okay, and a mental model is, you know, simply a frame of reference that we use to understand the world. And so in a leadership arena, you know, a mental model might be I have two options, well, maybe three as a leader. I can either, you know, take the heavy hand of an autocrat, tell people what to do, when to do it, how to do it, insist that they do it, punish them if they don't, and reward them if they do. They got to get on board. It's my way or the highway. Either way, it's going to be, you know, my way. So that's the one alternative. The other alternative might be a manager who says, well, you know, I pay a high cost in terms of interpersonal relations with my people. I pay a high cost in terms of morale. I pay a high cost in terms of alienating my people. So, gee, I don't want to be the autocratic bully, so I'll be the indulgent country club manager. And so, you know, a third option would be that they just kind of put their head in the sand and do the ostrich thing and avoid it altogether. And there are managers who do that. They don't typically survive very long. But, you know, if you're talking about change in a leadership approach an individual, if they get this mental model that says, I got one of these two alternatives, I either got to be an indulgent country club manager, I got to be the autocrat and get things done, they're constantly, you know, they may adopt one style predominantly until they get to the point where they see they're paying too much of a negative price and may shift to the other. But it's an inadequate mental model because there is another alternative, which is an alternative that some thinkers in my field called the servant leadership model. And we could spend time talking about that, but I mean, that's essentially the model of leadership that's depicted in the New Testament that Jesus Christ lays out for us. It's the model that was also perpetuated in other great leaders through the years, such as Gandhi and so on. But the idea is that there's this cognitive barrier can exist because people have an inadequate mental model. They don't understand what the alternatives, the possibilities might be. Second prong of that cognitive barrier is the idea that there might be inadequate self-awareness. You may, you know, accept the idea that there is this other alternative, this empowerment alternative, this servant leadership alternative, and you may think you're right smack dab in the middle of the prototype. More often than not, that's typically what the managers feel of themselves when I get involved to do, like, you know, management coaching or executive development types of things. Everybody comes in convinced that they're the prototype of the empowering manager until we start to collect evidence from their employees and direct reports and, you know, data to feed it back to them and put them into role play situations, let them see themselves on video, and all of a sudden their sense of inadequacy in terms of their own self-awareness becomes apparent. Without that, it's very difficult to invite people to change. They may feel that they're the prototype. Very few managers ever get to that point on their own. Very few leaders of any stripe I have ever been acquainted with get to that point on their own. As far as I know, there's only one leader I'm even remotely aware of that went through the process, and that was the great soul Mahatma Gandhi. I don't know how many of you are familiar with his story. Some years back, a Hollywood movie was made depicting his life, and at that point, most of us then became acquainted with him, and at least the Hollywood version of him. But I've recently been reading through his autobiography, which he interestingly calls The Story of My Experiments with Truth. And in that story, he talks about the evening when he was first confronted with racism in a very direct, violent, personal way. And that was when he was traveling in South Africa in a first-class coach and was kicked off rather violently by the conductor because he refused to give up his first-class seat and move back into third class where he'd been told to sit. Well, this was a time of cold weather in South Africa, and it was a very chilly night, the night that he spent on that train platform waiting for the train the next day. And as he sat there, he describes the process by which he began to reflect and review this injustice and started to work through his mind different kinds of strategies that he could formulate to address this. He thought of just leaving and going back to India, but very quickly determined that that would be the coward's way out and decided that was not an option for him. He thought about using force and violence and concluded very pragmatically that he had neither the physical nor political clout to force his agenda. And he says at the time, a third alternative started to sprout in his mind. He really didn't understand it at the time, and it took him several years to work it through, but he hit upon the idea of not passive but nonviolent resistance, that he would not submit but he would not confront with violence or enmity either. And as he started to reflect on this strategy, he describes how he got to the point where he began to reflect on how he had been treated by the conductor and the other officials on the train and had been kicked off, and also spent the night ruminating about the influence and impact of, you know, what I call unrighteous dominion. He didn't use those words when he was talking about it, but that's essentially what it was. And a very remarkable thing happened is that he says as he began to reflect on this unrighteous dominion with which he had been treated, he then began to ask himself the degree to which he was guilty of those same things in his relationship with his wife and his children and his colleagues. And by the next morning had decided that he could not condemn his adversaries for weaknesses that he himself had as well. And so in some instances, individuals will come to a sense of their own inadequacy in terms of their self-awareness and develop that self-realization. But until the point that occurs, individuals will be resistant to change. If they don't understand what their options are, and if they don't understand that they're here as opposed to there in terms of this change process, it's going to be very difficult to affect any kind of change through these cognitive barriers. A second set of barriers are what I would call affective sorts of barriers. And in the world of psychology and counseling, we refer to affect as the arena of human emotions, feelings, attitudes, what you like and what you don't like. To kind of bring this more to home, my guess is that everybody in here has an appropriate mental model in terms of the kind of lifestyle that's required to be physically fit, both in terms of physical activity and diet. Many of us, you know, further inculcation with that mental model and buying you a bathroom scale so that you've got an appropriate sense of self-awareness probably isn't going to get you off the dime if you're a lot more comfortable watching sports on TV than going out and playing it. And if you have a much keener taste for pizza as opposed to broccoli, those sorts of barriers operate a very, very different way than the cognitive sorts of barriers. You may know what you need to do, you may know that you need to do it, but you may be reluctant because it's uncomfortable. The idea in terms of changing your leadership style. You may know that you pay a price for being an autocrat. You may know that there's a better way, but it's uncomfortable. It's different. It's awkward. And until you get some familiarity with it, that can be a barrier as well. Skill set barriers, the third. That is, you may have a sense of what you need to do to change. You may have an idea to have an accurate mental model. You may be even comfortable with it. You may not have the skill set that you need to interact effectively at an interpersonal level with people to be a genuine empowerment kind of a leader. And there are things we talk more about there. But the fourth and final is the idea of ethical barriers, which is the idea of sometimes I run into situations with managers who just think that, moving away from my stick and carrot kind of treatment is wrong, given their views of human nature. If they believe that the people don't really want to work and they have to be forced, and that if that's the case, then in their mind it would be wrong to operate in a more empowering and democratic sort of a way. And that really kind of gets us back to the notion of underlying values and beliefs. Well, so what's the alternative? As I suggested a little bit earlier, there are examples in the New Testament where Jesus himself models many of these sorts of things. But what I thought I'd do is maybe end with a passage here from section 121 of the DNC that I'm sure we're all familiar with, starting in verse 39, because it maps out a fairly clear strategy, a goal that though for almost all mankind is a reach. In verse 39 of section 121, it says, "We've learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, be they on the right, the left, or the middle, as soon as they get a little authority as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion." And kind of operationally, the way I would describe that is the forcing of your agenda, whatever it might be, onto unwilling recipients. "Hence many are called, but few are chosen. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness and love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, as opposed to the kind of knowledge that most of us have in our views and opinions and beliefs that make us certain of the views that we hold. By kindness, pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and without guile, reproving by times with sharpness when moved upon by the Holy Ghost, and then showing forth afterwards an increase of love toward him whom thou hast reproved, lest he esteem thee to be his enemy, that he may know that thy faithfulness is stronger than the cords of death, that thy bowels also be full of charity towards all men and to the household of faith, and let virtue garnish thy thoughts unceasingly. And then shall thy confidence wax strong in the presence of God, and the doctrine of the priesthood shall distill upon thy soul as the dews from heaven." That is, kind of paraphrasing in a number of different ways, the way I often like to think about it is the idea of taking responsibility for yourself first, getting yourself into a position where you can invite people to join you, and then once they've been invited to that change process, it becomes a gift that they can either accept or reject. But anytime we exercise to give gifts that aren't wanted, even though we know it's good for the person, even though our motives may be pure and genuine and honest, we run the risk of the things we're warned against here in section 121. So I'll turn the time over to Jeff. He has a few words he'd like to say in response, and then we'll have a few minutes for some questions.
I'm going to be real brief. Just had a couple of things. I sent an email to Mike last week, and I'd been up at my parents' place in Hever having dinner, and they had some friends who had actually been a missionary companion of my father in Sweden in the 50s, and my mom asked me if I was going to go to any of the Sunstone sessions, and I said, "Well, actually, I'm responding to Mike, and they know Mike," and so my mom said, "What's Mike? You know, what's his topic?" And the person that was there was from Phoenix, and I don't know how much she knows about Sunstone, but I explained to her that Mike's an organizational psychologist, and he'd be talking about issues of structure and organizational dynamics, both generally and in the church. And she said, "Well, who is he to comment on the organizational structure of the church?" And And I tried to reassure her that he wasn't trying to dismantle the church, that he was just going to be talking about issues that we all face as we participate in organization. And it would be, I think it would be, it'd be very difficult to live in our society and not participate either as an organizational member of some kind or as a leader in an organization. And then that's really what Mike would be talking about. So I think Mike does have something to say. I'm, on the other hand, I'm like most of you, where rather than thinking about organizational theories and working with them on sort of a daily basis, I experience organizations the way you do, either as a member. Over the last couple of years, I have been working. We've got a company with about 100 employees, and I'm one of three people who try to give the appearance of directing this organization. And so my experience there has really been close to what Mike talked about at the end. Is prior to that, I'd spent 7 years more in a consultant capacity since I'd finished school, and now it's switched over to actually trying to run an organization. And my experience is really what Mike was pointing out, is that while I was critical of some organizational or leadership styles prior to that time, I then became more patient, and it reminded me, Gene England in some of his writing said there's constant pressure, and Gene's talking about the church, to be subject to leaders and occasionally to be hurt by their weakness and blindness, even unrighteous dominion, and then to be called to a leadership position and find that we too, with all the best intentions, can be weak and blind and unrighteous. And that's really been my experience, is that organizations today are complex, and there are many variables, and depending on where you are in the organization, your perspective is one reality, and the perspective from another point in the organization is another reality. And I think it's one of the benefits of being in a leadership position is hopefully it makes us tolerant of other leaders at other times. So that's one comment I wanted to make. The other was just really briefly, Mike's read a lot more of the literature than I have on leadership and cultural issues in organizations, but one of the pioneers really in this area is a professor back at MIT in the Sloan School of Management named Edgar, I don't know if it's Shine or Sheen, Shine, and he's really readable, and I just want to give you a real brief outline, and I think it complements sort of the direction Mike was going. His theory about organizational culture is that a charismatic leader who starts an organization will impose their assumptions on a group of people, and these assumptions become shared. And the most powerful of these assumptions are the ones that are implicit rather than the ones that are explicit. Over time, we sort of aren't aware of the assumptions we make, and so those are the sort of the powerful forces. And the role of a leader from that point on is then to sort of remove themselves from or step outside the organization and then look back in and say, which of these assumptions do we need to change in order to adapt and survive and grow and then integrate internally? And in some sense, I think that's what Sunstone does deliberately, is to sort of question the assumptions that we make as a people and to create dialogue about those assumptions. And so I think there's a lot of interesting things as we think about our relationship to other church members and as members of the church, where we can think about our cultural assumptions and then, play a role in the church in whatever direction we choose to by thinking about those. So those are really the points I wanted to hit on, and And then I think we have a few minutes left. We can open it up to questions.
This will be a sort of follow-up to the comment that the lady made at your parents' cabin up in Midway, Heber, wherever it is. When you're right, why do you worry about what other people think? And when it's going right, and it kind of Rod Decker last night when he was talking about how news commentators view the church and talk about it, and he said, you know, if I were running the church, I'm not sure I'd pay much attention to them because look how successful the church is. You know, it by almost any standard, it's a successful organization. And so, when you, as a priesthood leader, priesthood president, whatever it is, you feel that you've been called divinely, and you have the divine organization behind you, why do you need to worry about what somebody thinks underneath?
Is that a statement or a question? Well, I think really that's kind of the heart of the challenge. It communicates an underlying mental model of where those individuals are in terms of their own philosophy, their own beliefs and values and assumptions. You know, when you hear people say things like, our job as leaders is to keep the doctrine of the church pure, that communicates a mental model that says, A, we are pure, and B, we've got to keep it where it is. And it's not open to change or discussion. I guess there are a number of different ways to answer that in terms of philosophical and values and beliefs and spiritual sorts of things. But I think the more telling pragmatic question is, how do I, as a direct report or someone underneath that individual in the hierarchy, how do I respond and deal and react with that mental model when I don't share it? And I could suggest things to you all individually. I don't know that they would be answers that would be appropriate in all cases. For myself, I was touched very powerfully by Gandhi's response, and that was to turn inward and look at myself and kind of control those things in the world and the organizations I'm in that I do have control over. As of yet, not even my priesthood quorum presence or my bishop have come to me for advice and help on their mental models and this change process. And to the extent that I try occasionally in Sunday school classes or priesthood meetings where I might have a chance to influence it, I do, but it's usually pretty apparent very quickly whether or not they're interested in the gift that I'd like to share. And when that happens, I've got to decide. Well, they don't want it. Option A, I can force it. Right? And that has a lot of consequences, right? I can force it, and essentially when you do that, you're talking about unrighteous dominion just in reverse. I can put my head in the sand and, kind of sit in the hall and read Sunstone hidden between the covers of an ensign, and pretend like that's an option, and it works for many people. A third option would be to try and use the tools, techniques, strategy, I think, that are outlined in Section 121. Try and connect in terms of pure knowledge. And I think pure knowledge also, it goes directly to the question, do I really understand where they're coming from? And do understand their issues, their concerns, their fears, their the kind of things that they're considering. I think that's in large measure what we have to do when we approach things from pure knowledge, is recognize the fact that we're all deficient in terms of our knowledge. And so this third alternative, this empowerment kind of a knowledge of inviting people, can be achieved by what I like to call spinning up the other person's receptivity. And one of the greatest tools I've come upon pragmatically to help other people spin up receptivity with those over whom they have influence is to develop some really good listening skills. a not listening skills with the idea in mind of just shutting up long enough so you can talk while I'm formulating a response to tell you why you're wrong, but genuine, empathic listening skills where the other person feels a connection and a validation, and it's very difficult to do. In fact, I'd even go so far as to say that almost all mankind have a hard time doing that. You want to come up the microphone? We'll try and get on the tape that way.
Life of an organization is static. I just basically want to make a comment that that kind of assumption is that the life of an organization is static and doesn't.
Which assumption was that?
Doesn't change the assumption that. It was just shared before that you were responding to, and it doesn't take into account that the organization changed a lot during the life of Joseph and has continued to change a lot after his death, and it assumes that it's not going to keep growing and live off into the future. It almost condemns it to only exist in the present.
I think in a lot of respects, what we're looking at in that regard is something that that Nephi hit upon, the idea that there's opposition in all things. As I mentioned early on, one of the strong tendencies as we organize ourselves as human beings in our associations and try to structure the world around us is to impose order on chaos, to organize. But very, very quickly, that order can become oppressive. And so how do you counter that oppression? Well, there's only really one model that I know of that provides an enduring, charitable, and peaceful way of doing that, and that's the example that we find in the New Testament. So it's a challenge. Sure.
There's a couple of quick comments. one of the blessings of my life was that my final undergraduate summer session, actually, at the University of Utah in 1958, I had the great opportunity of taking a class in sociology of religion, another in sociology of complex organizations from Tom O'Day when he was a visiting professor of sociology at the University of Utah. One thing I remember from that course, a lot of things, but the one thing I remember specifically, religion needs most and suffers most from institutionalization. So it's a universal problem. Next comment, that is, perhaps we can use resources that exist in the organization. Brother Russell Ballard, for example, has shown some very enlightened instructions on how to conduct bishoprics meetings and various other meetings to be open to receptivity and input from the organization and so forth. And he's trying to, in many ways, revolutionize that, so let's build on what he and others have done.
I think we do have the tools, and we've just got to look for ways in our own circles of influence and spheres where we have an impact and do what we can, as opposed to worrying why everybody else is falling short in terms of their callings and stewardships. Are we out of time? All right, thank you.